Okay, so this was my assigned title, like many of you had. And I think this is actually a great title for the version of this talk 3 years from now. The truth is that what I'm going to actually really show you today is implication of X-ray emission from quasars, which may be TeV emission. I think the implications of the TeV emission are going to wait for us to evaluate a little more how important this is, what's going on. So this is a project that I've been working on for many years, actually since I was a graduate student, looking at the high energy X-ray to gamma ray emission from flat spectrum radio quasars, which, as I'm going to explain today, are sort of the opposite end of the spectrum from the TeV BLX that you guys have been mostly concerned with. These are sources that normally their inverse Compton spectrum is falling very quickly in the Fermi band, so you don't really expect much in the way of TeV emission. But something surprising turns out to happen when you look at what's happening far away from the central black hole, actually on hundreds of kiloparsec scales. So. I do want to put in a small plug for my university. I'm at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. That's not the one in College Park, so this is the second campus. We actually have quite a large physics department, about 25 faculty, 5 astronomers. That's our beautiful physics department with the dome on top. And I've done this work with a variety of people, but particularly Marco Sturgeonopoulos at UMBC is kind of my theorist. Bill Sparks, my ex-postdoc advisor at Space Telescope, and these other people listed here. Okay, so I'm one of the representative JETS people here. So I have to talk a little bit about why we are studying JETS, because a lot of this talk is really going to be jet physics, and we're going to get to the implications that are probably interesting to most of you at the end. So we're still studying JETS because they're interesting physical laboratories, and we don't understand a lot about them. We don't actually know, and this is something a lot of people don't realize, we don't know, of course, what the radiating particles are for sure. Now we have some evidence that there may be hadronic processes going on, which is quite exciting. And of course, tying these jets back to the black hole engine is still a very active topic of research. And then sort of in the wider picture, people who are interested in galaxy evolution feedback, which is more what we've been talking about at this meeting, of course, we need to understand more clearly, more quantitatively, how much energy are these jets actually carrying and dumping into their external environment. Just to summarize some of the unknowns that are still out there for jet physics. We don't understand their speeds on kiloparsec scales. We have some recent data from HST studies. So in my other life, I also do optical astronomy. This is just a plug for an interesting result we got recently published in Nature, which is this is actually an FR1 type jet. And we tracked one of these little blobs going with a superluminal speed of about 7C. And that's only the second strongly superluminal case measured on kiloparsec scales so far with optical, and we're hitting a few more of those. I guess I'll go ahead and play the movie just because you don't get movies of jets very often. So this is an image of the jet moving, and you can actually see the plasma moving out. So this whole thing is about 400 parsecs long, but it's not been deprojected, so the angle is quite small to the line of sight. Okay, so moving on. Okay, so other unknowns, matter content, as I already mentioned. And in some cases, we don't even know what radiation signature we're looking at, and that's actually one of the things that I'll talk about today. So I inserted a few slides this morning based on some of the talks yesterday, and I just kind of wanted to review the traditional view of jet physics from big picture. So of course, Fanaroff and Riley type 1 jets, these are the low power, low accretion rate jets, with a morphology that tends to have these very plumey, wide opening angle jets that fade with distance. And of course, standard unification says that BLAC objects are what these guys look like when they're aligned to the line of sight. We also call blazars the aligned population of FR2 galaxies, which are the really powerful guys. And in those cases, those are called flat spectrum radio quasars, but blazars generally includes both classes. Okay. So I just wanted to show those pictures today. So today what I'm going to be talking about are FR2 type galaxies. Okay, so when we're studying blazars, it's good to remember, so this is an archival spectrum of a source that I forgot to put the name up, but this is a very typical long-term average SED for a blazar, right? You see the typical synchrotron peak, inverse Compton peak over here. And we often characterize blazars by the frequency of the peak of the synchrotron emission, not for any particularly great reason, except that it's just something that we can try to measure, given that these are very broad spectra. And this peak can can range from 10 to the 12 hertz up to 10 to the 17, which is 5 orders of magnitude. Luminosity can also vary by up to 5 orders of magnitude, which is huge. That means that within the blazar population, phenomenologically, there's a huge range of SEDs that you could see. So they could peak from all over this this area here. So 15 years ago, or more actually at this point, my thesis advisor, Giovanni Fossati, published the famous blazar sequence that tried to put some order in this spectral types of blazars. And what he found is basically that the most powerful sources have low frequency synchrotron peaks, and the most weak, the most lowest luminosity blazars tend to have synchrotron peaks up in the X-ray. And I'm just showing you this because I'm sure many of you have seen it before, but that what we're talking about when we're talking about TV BLX are these very low power objects that are peaking in the X-rays with their synchrotron peaks. So this is the population that we're interested in, even though only a subset of them, of course, end up showing up in the TEV surveys. I know Marco's going to talk about this a little bit, but I just threw a couple of bullet points here. FR1s have long been known to be either non or negatively evolved. And HSP BLX, that's the high synchrotron peaking BLX, this low luminosity population, are also known to be the most negatively evolved population out there. And that may indicate an evolutionary sequence, but as I said, I'll let Marco talk about that. So what I wanted to clarify before I get onto the work that I'm going to talk about is not all BLX are TEV BLX. This is, the truth is that we have a whole giant population that actually peaks over here at low peak frequencies. This figure is from a paper from 2011 that I wrote that basically tried to make the case that actually these low peaking BLX are misaligned high frequency BLX. So that would make, that would mean that there's actually a larger population that we might have assumed. I'm not actually totally sure if this is correct, but if you're interested in it, you can ask me about it. Okay, so this is a typical spectrum of a flat spectrum radio quasar. It's 3C273, very, very famous source. So you have the synchrotron spectrum peaking somewhere here, and you have the inverse Compton spectrum. This is the Fermi band. You can see that it's very, very soft in the Fermi band. So this is a source where the inverse Compton peak is in MEV range, and you would not expect TEV emission. It's been observed by Hess and other telescopes, and there's no TEV emission. And this is now a somewhat out of date picture. I should have grabbed the one probably from the most recent catalog. I think this is the 2FGLs. But this is the Fermi inverse Compton luminosity versus the energy index. Blue sources here are your BLX. So obviously the sources that have lower energy index are the ones that you're going to be picking up in TEV surveys. Most of the flat spectrum radio quasars are these red triangles here. So you may detect one, two, a few of these in TEV surveys. They're not going to be your dominant source population. So you might be inclined looking at this to just forget about FSRQs altogether in terms of TEV output. But as I said, I will try to convince you that that's not the case. Okay, so the story I'm going to tell today has a little bit of a history behind it. So what I want to talk about is the rise of something called the inverse Compton model, particularly the inverse Compton of the CMB model for X-rays from jets. So back in 1999, Chandra, the X-ray telescope, was launched. Chandra, of course, is the best telescope for very high spatial resolution. They were focusing the telescope, and they picked a nice quasar in the southern sky that they thought would be a really nice point source, and it turned out not to be a point source. Turns out that there's a jet right here. It's about 7% of the flux of the core, which is very, very high. That was unexpected, and the reason that was unexpected is that we had, of course, observed X-rays from jets, especially nearby ones that are a bit bigger, with previous X-ray telescopes. This is an example of M87, very famous FR1 type jet, and you have a radio optical X-ray spectrum like this that just turns over, and you get the X-rays on the backside of the synchrotron. And we were expecting, in the case of PARC-0637, this source that I just showed you, which is an FR2, we were expecting no X-rays because the radio optical spectrum does something like this. And this green lines here, these indicate the X-ray flux and also the fact that it's very, very hard. So this is a very hard, high X-ray flux seen from these knots in the jet. So these are, we're talking 100 kiloparsecs from the black hole. So very, very far out. Okay, so these X-rays were not expected. You might have expected a much lower synchrotron self-Compton spectrum, but we're talking 3-4 orders of magnitude below this observation, and you can't make it work by beaming or magnetic field. You just push everything to completely unreasonable values. So this was a mystery. People were quite surprised by this. the original papers by Chartas and Schwartz. Here they extensively go through different possibilities for these x-rays. They rule out thermal Bremsstrahlung, synchrotron self-Compton. In the original papers, they ruled out inverse Compton off of the CMB because it had long been assumed that 100 kiloparsecs from the core, these jets are only mildly relativistic. They are not going with a very high Lorentz factor. And they also obviously rule out a single synchrotron spectrum. So they left open the possibility for a second synchrotron spectrum, so just two electron populations with different peak energies. And they didn't like that because it didn't really make a lot of sense. It was very ad hoc. Why would you get the second population? It wasn't consistent with any theoretical model in particular. So very shortly after this discovery paper, two Italian teams published basically the same result concurrently to Vecchio and Celotti, and they said, actually, let's go back to ICCMB. We can rescue this model. What we will do is we will look at the parsec scale jet, and we'll see that this Parxo 637 source had superluminal motions on the order of 13C, so very, very fast. So that means that it's very highly relativistic on parsec scales. And they said, well, let's just make the very simple extension that the jet remains very highly relativistic on kiloparsec scales. If you do that, then you basically boost up your inverse Compton emission to hit those x-rays. So that works. So this is a figure from that paper. This is the core. You can ignore that. This is what's going on in the large-scale jet. So you have the radio, optical, x-ray, and this line running through these very sparse points is the inverse Compton CMB model. And it works. You take a Lorentz factor of about 15, which is consistent with the parsec scale jet. You just point the thing very close along our line of sight, and you basically get the inverse Compton emission. It works pretty well. You don't have to have crazy B fields or super crazy jet powers. So this became a small cottage industry because this was not the only source that Chandra observed like this. In fact, practically all of the major quasar jets that Chandra has observed have this feature of very high and almost high X-ray fluxes. So it seems to be almost ubiquitous. There was actually a recent Chandra News article, I think this was in 2014, highlighting this. So lots and lots of beautiful, these are all jets that are, you know, anywhere from 10 to 50 to 100 kiloparsecs from the black hole, and they're all anomalously high. And these are just some of the authors that have worked on this. It's actually quite a large group. There were some issues raised with the ICCMB model by a few voices of dissent in the wilderness. Frequently observed a decrease in x-rays relative to radio as you go out in the jet. But people got around that. They said, okay, we have a decelerating flow, so they can work that. There were other issues. Some of the jets that were modeled required super Eddington jet power. Possible, but starts to make you a little uncomfortable. More problematic would be the small angles to the line of sight to get that Doppler boosted emission were sometimes so small that it required a jet length of more than, say, 2-3 megaparsecs, which starts to become a little crazy because that's the absolute longest we have observed on the plane of the sky. And so basically, in many cases, the inverse Compton CMB fit was basically uncomfortable. It wasn't quite ruled out, but it was starting to become squeezed into a weird part of the parameter space. Plenty of people, Jester, Uchiyama, Hardcastle, all said, you know, a second synchrotron spectrum is still viable and maybe a better explanation. Certainly, it's a more efficient process, so you do not need the high jet powers. Hadronic models were also pretty much ignored, mostly because these are very difficult models, and you can tune them quite well to match a lot of different observations. So when you cannot constrain things, people tend to just ignore them. So the essential problem, if we restrict our thinking to the second synchrotron possibility and the inverse Compton possibility, is that if you're just looking at radio optical X-ray, no matter how great your resolution is, you can really fit the SED to both models equally well. So this is some data. It's not terribly easy to see. This is radio, infrared, optical, UV, X-ray, same data in both plots. This is an inverse Compton CMB model. This is a synchrotron, double synchrotron model. Works. So this is from Kara et al. 2013, basically showing that both of these models are perfectly fine. The way they got around it is they found that this UV component here was 30% polarized, which is not expected in the inverse Compton case. So they were the first guys to conclusively show that this second component probably is synchrotron, given the high polarization. So that brings me to my work. This was an idea by my collaborator, Marco Sturgeonopoulos, back in 2006. He said, okay, the inverse Compton CMB model is full swing. Everybody loves it. All the jet papers favor this idea. But if you want the inverse Compton component to match these x-rays, there's only one free parameter. It's B over delta. That's magnetic field over Doppler beaming factor. So you can see here I'm playing around with scaling the inverse Compton component so I can get it too low, too high, just right. That means exactly one value of B over delta. And you can think of this spectrum as basically a copy of the synchrotron spectrum because it's the same electron population. So that means that if you're hitting these x-rays, then the rest of your spectrum is essentially fixed. There's not much that you can do there. There's not really anything to tune. And what he noticed was that if you're hitting these x-rays, which are actually would be coming from very low energy electrons in the synchrotron spectrum from down here before we can actually observe them, then you're also predicting a very, very high GeV flux, Fermi band flux. And so he proposed that we might be able to detect it with Fermi. This was back in 2006, GLAST, then Fermi was launched in 2008. So I picked up this project in around 2009. Looking at 3C273, this is a very, very famous jet. This is what it looks like in the optical. Here's the extremely bright quasar core. This is 24 arc seconds out from the core, so this is kiloparsec scale. And the idea was, again, I'm not showing the x-ray image, but this jet was very, very bright and had a hard x-ray flux, especially at the front part of the jet. So we wanted to see if we could see this inverse Compton GeV spectrum. The only problem is that Fermi has a very bad resolution. It's about 24 arc seconds long. Clearly, that's well within the PSF of the instrument. So we had to be a little clever. We had to basically wait for the source to come, the core to calm down. So this is a light curve. This is about 1 year in, 2 year into the Fermi mission. And eventually, the core became quiescent and started giving us upper limits. And so we started stacking up these upper limit times to see if we could get either a low enough upper limit to rule out the GeV emission, or actually what I was always hoping when I was working on this project was to actually detect it, that we would see a steady floor that would correspond to this hard GeV component from the large-scale jet. So we never did detect it. We ended up getting extremely low upper limits. This light curve is a little out of date. We're now into 8 years of Fermi. This is now a view of the 3C273 spectrum. So there's in the black line, I'm showing the first two most prominent knots. The yellow line is just one, the single most prominent knot. So this is the radio optical. You can see that the UV is already picking up into the second component here. To meet the x-rays, and this is the projected inverse Compton spectrum, and the green upper limits here clearly rule this out at an extremely high level of confidence. So, and it should be mentioned that variability doesn't get you out here, because the inverse Compton spectrum that far out should be completely stable with timescales of hundreds to thousands of years. So this was quite a surprise for us. We were expecting that we would see the inverse Compton spectrum. So we were a little disappointed at first that you cannot make these two things agree. I'm going to take a small aside, again, because I do optical astronomy also, and mention that actually, if you weren't convinced by that for some reason, we also rule out the inverse Compton model in a completely different way, which is that I've been looking at proper motions of jets in the optical, and we looked at 3C273 over 20 years, from 1995 to 2003, 2014, and nothing in this jet is moving. And the inverse Compton model requires these knots to basically be little ballistic packets that are moving with a significant proper motion. So we got limits on the order of 1C for this jet in terms of superluminal motion. So if it's not moving, then the x-rays cannot be inverse Compton. So that's a second nail in the coffin for that model. After this paper, which was published in 2014, we went back to Parkes 0637, which was the original jet that Chandra was focusing on and detected this serendipitous jet. And again, we found exactly the same thing, that we could rule out the inverse Compton model very strongly, at a very high degree of confidence. So this was quite surprising for the community. I think that they have come around to accepting this result, especially now that we have two and we're working on a couple dozen more. And so we have to think about the implications for this. So I do want to mention also that one goodie that we get out of these upper limits is that inverse Compton is a mandatory process. You have these relativistic electrons, you have a CMB photon field, you must be upscattering it. It depends, again, the level of this curve which has to be here at some level, depends only on B over delta. So if you assume an equipartition magnetic field, then you can put limits on the Doppler beaming factor in the large scale jet. And so we get those limits for 373 and 0637 of a moderately slow delta less than 7.8 or less than 6.5, again, assuming equipartition. But there are reasons why we think you cannot deviate too far away from that. So takeaway number one, the ICCMB model is in trouble. We have the polarization measurement of Kara 2013. We have these two cases where we had the lack of gamma rays. So that means it's probably not the correct model. Takeaway number two is that the only alternative at this point is a second synchrotron component. So we must have some mechanism of producing up to TeV electrons in these jets that are possibly, presumably, spatially separated, and we're just not able to see that very well with our telescopes. And the thing that's a challenge to theorists is that we really don't, we never had any models that said that should happen, so now we have to come up with a model that says that should happen. Okay, so now to get to the part that's probably most interesting to this crowd. So the consolation prize for the jets being slow on kiloparsec scales, as I say, is that we're actually going to get TeV emission out. That's because we have TeV electrons now giving us these X-rays, so they must again be inverse compton scattered up to TeV energies. So there's a lot going on in this figure. The gray points here are the core points from the very, very bright quasar core. So you can largely ignore them, except that what I've done here is try to show that if you actually account for beaming, most of the emission is not coming necessarily from the core, which is what I think most of us intuitively think. So if you do a beaming correction for these gray points which come from the core, you get this blue dashed line. Okay, so that's the angle integrated luminosity. Now, if you look at the knots, which of course are these gray triangles, sorry, it's a little bit hard to see here, this gray line here. So this is the observed flux. So again, if you look at an observed flux, of course the core is ridiculously dominant over the knots. But if you make the beaming correction for the knots, because they are slower, that beaming correction doesn't drop them down as much. So the actual comparison in terms of total power output should be this blue line in the core to this gray zone for the knots. So the reason it's a zone is we don't know exactly what the Doppler factor is. And in fact, for the blue dashed line, I've also assumed the maximum Doppler factor, so you could drop that also. So this already shows that these guys are actually comparable in some regimes like the X-rays and low frequency radio. More importantly though, this double synchrotron spectrum, so this gray zone here, is gonna give you an inverse Compton spectrum somewhere in this sort of aqua colored zone here. And I've circled in red the TeV emission. So what, I don't think I put the animation on here, but if you think of a typical TeV BLAC, it's gonna show up at say 10 to the 43 observed luminosity, incorrectly assuming isotropy. If you make a beaming correction, the total 4 pi luminosity of a TeV BLAC is probably more like 10 to the 41. So you'll notice that even our lowest limit projection, which assumes that this thing is mildly relativistic with a gamma of 1.9, is giving an angle integrated TeV emission that's greater than 10 to the 41, possibly by as much as an order of magnitude. And this is for 3C273. We did the same figure for Parkes 0637, and because the X-rays are so hard, you actually get quite a narrow range for the TeV emission. And again, you're looking at angle integrated luminosities between 10 to the 42 and 10 to the 43. So 1 to 2 orders of magnitude higher than what you get from a TeV BLAC. Okay, so unfortunately, I don't have more examples of these, but we are working on them. And I think this is gonna be pretty common. This is what we're gonna see all over the place. So the takeaways, I'm not sure, we started a bit late, so I'm not sure how. Okay, great. So so the takeaways are inverse Compton of the CMB is not the cause of the anomalously high X-rays in at least 3 sources. And we have several more to test. I think this is likely this is gonna be true for the rest of the sample. We still have a mystery, which is what is the source of this second synchrotron component? Why does it appear co-spatial? And why does it decrease as you go down the jet? Another takeaway is that on the kiloparsec scale, these jets are not highly, highly relativistic. They can be moderately relativistic within our limits, but not highly relativistic. a prediction. I think Fermi, of course, is scanning the sky all the time. It has no consumables, so hopefully it'll have a very long lifetime. And at high energies, which is where we're getting most of our best limits, there's almost no background. So the limits are going down as 1/time, which means that I think Fermi will eventually detect that ICCMB component that must be there. And that means that we will be able to make a direct measurement of B over delta, which is really nice, because those are difficult measurements to make. As I mentioned, the synchrotron X-ray should give us lots of TeV emission, if that is really the correct interpretation. Almost certainly more than TeV blazars in total luminosity. Now, how that matters to heating is another question, and I'll mention a couple of questions about that in the next slides. But it may turn out to be important. Finally, another prediction, either Fermi or CTA should detect this TeV component. So I didn't put it on the previous plots, but of course I was looking in the aqua zone was the angle integrated. If we actually look at what the beamed flux would be, it's going to be higher, depending on your exact Doppler factor. And for 3C73, I think it was just barely within reach of a CTA detection, quite a long one, but it would be possible. And I have an undergraduate student right now who's crunching the numbers on all of the anomalous X-ray jets. He just sent me a spreadsheet this morning, but unfortunately I couldn't squeeze it into the talk in time. And he's basically looking at what that predicted TeV flux will be and if it'll be detectable by CTA. It would also, in some cases, be possible to detect this component at the highest energy bands of Fermi, because sometimes we actually see the second component starting in the optical UV. So that would land you in the upper end of the Fermi range. So I really hope, as I said, in 2-3 years that we will have a lot more certainty about this component being real. Okay, so now this is kind of the discussion slide. So as I said, the title of the talk was implications. I'm not sure what the implications are. Just simply that I think FSRQs are going to be a TeV source class. They are, of course, a completely different population than the traditional TeV BLX. They are positively evolving, like FR2s. They are much more dominant at high redshifts. The total 4-pi integrated TeV power is probably 1 to 2 orders of magnitude, or at least comparable to the TeV BLX. This is, of course, still subject to uncertainties in the magnetic field strength. And the speed on kiloparsec scales, but again, as Fermi continues to scan the sky, I think we'll start getting actual measurements and better constraints on that. All of that's great, but there's a couple of buts. It's not clear how beamed how much these TeV beams are really beamed. Obviously, the speeds are slower on these scales, so I think you might ask questions about if there's a critical density there. There's another big if, which is if these X-rays are hadronic, then we may not see TeV emission at all. Okay, so one of the things that I'm working on is trying to find diagnostics for hadronic models. It's very, very difficult, but it's important for reasons like this. So we have, of course, very recently a single neutrino detection, which has been correlated with the blazar flare. That could be, I think they've correlated about 95%. So if you believe that, then this is a serious concern. However, qualitatively, I still would put money on forward reverse shocks producing a dual synchrotron spectra. And that's based on, in some cases, we have actually seen offsets, paired offsets of optical X-ray in the knots. All this remains to be seen. So follow up, we have new HST Chandra observations of 8 more jets, and we're basically hitting a big archival effort on about 24 other jets. So we should be able to do what we've done with these two for about 24 total. We're also doing a variability study for Chandra X-ray jets. If you see variability, then you must be looking at synchrotron again. And again, the ongoing look for the TeV upturn at the highest Fermi energies. That's our best bet for now until CTA gets online. So again, I have a student working on a population study of these jets to estimate the TeV emission. Those results should be out actually quite soon. So if you're interested in a preprint when this comes out in a month or two, just email me. And that's it.
We have plenty of time for questions.
Yeah, regarding the secondary synchrotron origin, mm-hmm. There's this process that people refer to as electrostatic gravity stratum, or its inverse quantum scattering of electrostatic waves.
Mm.
And because the electron doesn't care whether it scatters a longitudinal electric field or transverse electric field, like in a photon. Now, that has the same polarization properties as synchrotron radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think normally the typical frequency of the electrostatic waves is much higher than the gyro frequency, but that would really give you a second inverse plasmon scattering component, which looks like synchrotron, because synchrotron you also could discuss as inverse quantum scattering of the virtual photons.
Mm.
So, and I think that can help you out.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have to be very careful I think all your inverse quantum calculations are done in the Thomson domain, from what I could see.
No.
So you have to be careful that you don't hit the Kleine-Scheiner threshold, and then the efficiency of the scattering at high energies will go down.
That's true, although I think that's been accounted for, at least in the papers we've published so far.
And I think you should also be a little bit more careful, because your electron distribution functions might be evolving.
Yes.
And I think all these fits assume that the spectrum is given for all time and it stays fixed, and this is simply not true. Even out there.
Yes. They're very slowly evolving compared to the laser core, of course.
And it's not clear whether these data points have been taken at the same time and contemporaneous, or whether you.
In the case of the optical, as I showed, I mean, the thing did not change to within 5% in flux. Over 20 years, not a single change.
But I think this inverse plasmon scattering would give you something that you call the secondary synchrotron. So you could just treat it like synchrotron with a higher magnetic field strength. And it's a process that I can give you references.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Years, but people ignore it. Astrophysicists ignore it.
Yes. No, we are bad at that. We should not ignore things.
Yeah, questions?
Well, you talked about not A, not moving is an argument against ICCMB.
Mm-hmm.
That presumes all the knots are moving with the bulk velocity of the jet and aren't some sort of
pattern. Right, that's correct. Yes.
So I think even in M87, right, we see some things move and some things clearly don't.
Yes.
And so is it. Is it obvious that not A should be one of the things that should be moved?
Yes, because I'm trying to remember the exact argument, but basically, if the fact that these are organized into knots in the first place is not actually consistent with the very first kind of ICCMB model you would come up with. You'd have a very nice continuous flow. So if you're going to trap the plasma in little blobs, then they have to be moving. So there's no way out there. So it's You're right that we've ruled out proper motions, but not fast flows. But the proper motions were required by the ICCMB model.
But the knots might just be where the bulk flow has been randomized a little bit, right? So the knots are they're presumably synchrotron emission.
Mm-hmm.
So if we just had a very very fast jet where all the internal particles were moving with the drift speed along the jet, so the bulk jet flow, then they could be within the jet, locally very cold, and you wouldn't necessarily see the synchrotron emission.
Yes.
It's only when they become randomized or additionally energized.
No, and that's, in fact, this jet is like that, because you see that it's completely invisible, and then all of a sudden it blows up at not A. So, yes.
But would that argue that the not A would still be moving then? Suddenly get randomized?
Well, I don't know. If not A were driven by a shock,
I think it's
shocking on some external object or something. I'm not sure how far. That's got to be well within where you'd expect a reverse shock. So. But if it was a shock, then it would be thermalizing some of the bulk motion or randomizing some of the bulk motion so that you'd see it, but then the pattern frequency is set by whatever's driving the shock. And then all the invisible parts are the parts where it's sticking out, and that's presumably.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, One other question about, you're talking about beaming and the FSRQs.
Yes.
So one of the takeaways, as I understood it, was that the overall PEV luminosity of the FSRQs could be much higher than that of the VLX, just
yes.
Not necessarily beamed.
But just not necessarily very tightly beamed, which I think, if I remember from talking to Phil, would maybe be an issue, because you wanted these very tight beams to get the instability going. So
the instability requires a high flux.
Yeah.
Okay, so the collimation, the beam, the plasma beam, and all of that happens just because everything's happening far away. But it still needs, there's a floor on the local flux.
Yeah.
And so that's certainly true.
So that's probably what we would want to calculate, is part of figuring out how important this is. Yeah.
Is there any hope to get a good constraint on the beam?
Yeah, that's what I said. If Fermi can eventually detect this, that fixes B over delta for the synchrotron component. So that that could help you quite a bit, because again, you have arguments for why the B field cannot be very different from micropartition. Still a source of uncertainty, but.
And is there any if there is a room talk to do support the campaign to try to look at this using one of these Hess or Veritas?
We looked into it, and these two jets are going to be too faint. But that's what I have this student that's crunching the numbers for the entire other sample, because the other sample has not been proved to be synchrotron X-rays. But if we make the leap that because these three are, they are, then we can just go ahead and observe them anyway and see if they show up. So we're trying to figure out which one of these is the best candidate for a detection with the TEV telescopes we currently have.
Endless supply
of questions.
So how come something like
synchrotron self-Compton? Let's see. I may have some.
Why does it have to be IC CMB and not IC some other photon band?
If I remember, it's just very, very, very weak. I have some notes on this from one of the early slides. So. Yeah, if I remember, I think you had to push the B field to a high level, and the Doppler factor had to be a ludicrously low level. So the Doppler factor had to be like 0.01, which makes no sense for a jet that looks like that. That's pretty clearly one-sided. If you look at the Schwartz et al. 2000 paper, they pretty extensively go through it. And that I remember that they did the calculation, and they said off the bat, this is ruled out. It's totally doesn't work. The SSC emission, this is the best case you can get, which is quite far. This is a large scale here, quite far from the observed flux. And then if you try to align the jet and create more beaming, you actually make things worse. So
is that just one zone model?
That probably, yes.
One thing that very naively I might guess would be that If you had the inverse Compton component coming from a region very compact down, but not co-located with the core, or I guess that doesn't quite work.
Mm.
Well, I'm just wondering, can you absorb the GEV signal?
No, I don't think so. And in fact, that's probably the more relevant thing to say, which is that if we rule out ICCMB, we also rule out SSC. So, with the gamma ray limits. I think that the most compelling case so far, I mean, this is an interesting application, the Fermi limits, but that UV 30% polarization is probably the most smoking gun against the inverse Compton off the CMB. It's, CMB is not polarized, so you don't expect ICCMB to be polarized.
But inverse Compton from jets from an anisotropic medium can be polarized up to 100%.
Yeah, I think, well, that's true. I think technically you could accommodate it, but it would require very, very weird part of the parameter space. So I think that is true. I think it was basically ruled out.